Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also simulcasting 101.1 FM and 90.7 FM throughout northern New Mexico. Retune your radio dials. We are podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, we are going to meet Fernando Garavito. He is an author from Colombia who lives in Santa Fe, and we'll be talking about him and his new book. Right now, I would like to welcome Joseph Sanchez. He is co-curator, along with Mateo Romero, of the exhibition War Paint, which is at the Institute of American Indian Arts in downtown Santa Fe, through the 13th of January, 2008. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Now, this is an exhibition of art and poetry about the Native American experience of U.S. wars. How did the idea arise for the exhibition?
Well, I think, you know, Mateo's had this idea in his head for a long time to do paintings reflecting his father's journals and also the journals of his nephew, who was in Iraq. And myself, I'm always been interested in doing a show about the Native war experience. And this was an opportunity to bring in families as well, how the families are affected as well as the veterans themselves.
Now, do you have firsthand experience in the armed forces?
I was in the Marine Corps for 32 months.
When was that?
Vietnam.
Uh-huh. And so it's interesting because the exhibition covers the whole, well, not World War I, I guess, does it?
No, we started
from World War II on, and the very different experiences there. One of the artists, Deani Reynolds Whitehawk, writes about the piece honoring veterans acknowledging atrocities and refers to the quote-unquote seesawing in Native communities between patriotism and tribal nationalism. Tell us more about that seesawing.
Well, I think, you know, it's Natives have been very patriotic people, and certainly they honor their veterans by taking care of them when they come back from the war, which is unlike a lot of the experiences a lot of the other veterans have had that were non-Native, who come back to community and there's no hope for them.
What is the nature of the help that Native veterans get from their communities when they come home from war?
Well, they actually come home to a community. You know, they come home to a family who understands some of the problems, and they've been addressing it through dancing, prayer, things like that that are... is in an effort to try to deprogram some of that kind of a stress of war, that so to speak.
Does it work?
Well, I think it works for some of the people that didn't see the hardest action. You know, it's very difficult if you're in force recon or any of the kinds of advance Navy SEALs or any of those advanced units. The training is different, more intense, and so these guys are... they're trained to kill. It's very hard to come back and, you know, play with the puppies, so to speak. You know, it's not easy to back off that whole war experience. And especially if, I know some of the young veterans talked about having to shoot or experience the death of children. And it's probably one of the most traumatic and the hardest to forget. So it's not an easy thing, and the whole training's not an easy thing, you know.
Well, it's interesting. There's one artist in the show, Monty Singer, who wrote a very striking text that's on the wall about how the U.S. Marines' philosophy, which said basically, you know, during this training you're going to leave your old self behind, your old self is going to die, and you're going to become a Marine, which is a whole new thing. And he said it didn't really even... it didn't apply to him because the Marine philosophy and the Navajo philosophy were nearly identical. They were both warrior philosophies.
Well, I think that's true in the pure sense. And he goes on to mention that you know, ideally, the Marine Corps is talking about honor, justice. In war, all those things can't possibly happen, you know, especially if it's a war that's unpopular or... with issues that aren't necessarily resolved, such as Iraq or even Vietnam. You know, there ends up being guilt and uncertainty. But in the pure sense, that philosophy of being the one, the only, the true, you know, whatever it is, I used to know it by heart, but I don't anymore. It is very similar to a native philosophy. You know, it's all about the honor and protection of your community.
We're talking to Joseph Sanchez, co-curator of the exhibition War Paint, which is at the Institute of American Indian Arts in downtown Santa Fe. There are some deep war wounds from Vietnam that are expressed in the poetry of T.C. Cannon. Tell us about T.C. Cannon.
Well, T.C. is kind of, Native America is one of Native America's most famous artists. Kind of created modern Indian painting, or at least given a lot of credit for it. And he decided to go to Vietnam, enlist. And
voluntarily.
Voluntarily. One of the many that done it. I believe it's close to 90% of natives volunteer for service. And he went over there as an 18-year-old with high hopes and ideas of honor, and it quickly came to pass that it was not at all like that. So being talented as he was able to do drawings about the war, and especially I think his poetry is really just right on about the stress of a young man having to change his entire life, and to come back, then coming back was even worse because you wouldn't really accept it coming back. You know, there was a lot of conflict. You know,
did he go back into a native community?
He did, and he came back to Santa Fe as well. But you know, the whole idea of during Vietnam, they would, you know, war protesters throw stuff at soldiers. It wasn't easy for them to come back as well. So there's a little bit of that happening with Iraq, but I think it's a little more intense during Vietnam.
Yeah, it seems that the at this point the war protest is directed toward the administration and not toward the soldiers.
I think that's a good thing, you know, because it's truly that's the problem. You know, he's not watching out for his own men.
Would you like to read any of the poems of T.C. Cannon?
The cover poem is a very nice one, which is it's called John American Horse. And he says, "My grandfather said to arise and start a rumbling through the land. My grandfather told me to thrust my lance into the arm of America. He is colored red. Color him the colors of the earth, for his head is the sun, and his feet are the moon. His body is not asphalt, but buffalo grass. His sustenance is truth and believing, and his air is without ghost-like limping sirens. Down the street the sirens creep and haunt. The city's red people, in dark neon shadows, they creep without coup and feathers, without song and celebration, they creep with hearses and flashlights. These sirens and siren driver, who have never seen satisfaction and justice. I am John American Horse, RA12345678, Vietnam veteran exclusive, with a mouth of blood and a hungry lance." So I think he's talking about, you know, coming back to America and the alcoholism and the drug problems and the violence that ends up, a lot of veterans end up, you know, not surviving the experience. You know, they're, as in the case of Mateo's nephew who's in prison right now.
Is that right?
He came back from Iraq and he was trained to be kind of a criminal, and that's the way he felt. And he also went over there for one term and they left him on for several. And so they were making promises they couldn't keep. And they did that as well in Vietnam. You know, and I think it's good to serve. And some of the stuff that you'll see in the exhibition, the audio tape by Hayes Lewis describes how his community took him and they prayed with him before he went, and they prayed with him when he came back. So some people got a lot of that, and those that did, you know, survived better. You know, if you're an urban Indian, you might not get some of that. And, you know, the show also deals with the different families that have suffered from either abuse or from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah, there's a young woman artist who's makes almost like comic book type figures, like of women warriors.
Yes, Jolene Nenevah Yazzie. There are no comic book heroes that are Indian women. There's been maybe five or six in the whole history of comic books of Indian men, but no women. And her family suffered a lot of domestic abuse, starting from World War II. And literally the women have banded together within her family to become these super women. And they're stronger now for it. And that's what she talks about, how they've become superheroes in their own right. And that's why she calls herself the warrior women of her clan.
There's such a variety of artistic styles in the exhibition, you know, with comic books and then sculpture and then Mateo Romero's paintings that are based on photography.
I think it shows, like, the diversity that's happening within Native art. Also, the age difference. There's the youngest artist is probably in her 20s. So, you know, they're learning new techniques and they're willing to use them and in a very dramatic way. You know, her pieces, Jolene's pieces, for instance, are very dramatic. The Navajo clown pieces, it discusses war in a kind of unsettling way. You know, they have kind of a bloody figure. You don't know whether it's blood or the stain of war, you know. But the piece by Douglas Miles, which discusses his father, who was the first native to vote in Gila County in Arizona. He came back from World War II and found out he didn't even have the right to vote, even though he was a decorated airborne veteran. And so this is very recent. That's 48. That's not even barely 60 years ago. You know, natives didn't have the right to vote in this country, and even later for some in the East Coast, as late as 54, I believe.
And then there's one artist whose father and grandfather were veterans, and then he was born because of, I think it was Agent Orange exposure, was born disabled and was not able to go into the armed forces. And there's a quote, how does it go? The Marine Corps won't take disabled people, it will only create them.
Yeah, he told me that currently the Marine Corps doesn't accept people with disabilities. They just create them. And he says, I believe the blood remembers. I believe in defending your nation. Blood taught me that. Agent Orange took my right side. Am I a veteran? I bear the wounds of proximity. A very powerful artist. His father, Frank Hyde, and his father is Doug Hyde, who served two terms in Vietnam. And his son was born with no arm from his elbow on his right side and no leg from his knee down. He's a very powerful artist. The powerful piece about him was a young child playing with toys, and he's surrounded by the toys of war. So that's, and his poetry is very powerful. You know, his whole family's been veterans, so, you know, it's something he feels strongly about.
And he was able to become an artist using one side of his body.
Yes, in spite of all that, he's very powerful and very, one of my favorite artists, young artists that's happening right now, because he's a dedicated worker, does interesting work.
Do a lot of the young artists are they coming out of the Institute of American Indian Arts?
Yes, we have really a great crop of young artists coming out who are exploring new issues of what it is to be a Native American in the 21st century, and what it is to make art that is Native American by our own terms, not necessarily the terms of what art history says, or even things like Indian Market. You know, the Indian art market has been essentially controlled by other people's ideas, and now I would say the young people and the young curators. I just came from a conference where the young curators spoke directly on that, how we learn to choose our own path, and maybe we can help other people understand what it is we're doing, because we speak from a cultural point of view as well as living in this society, contemporary society.
Yeah, I would think on the one hand you've got the influence of American culture and world art history in the Euro-American tradition, and then you have Native American artistic traditions, which are, you know, to what extent are they relevant to today's life? I'm sure people are asking that question as well.
Well, I think, you know, they're really relevant. You know, I think the world's looking to some of those values that are part of Native American tradition to help kind of solve the way we live together. You know, it's our biggest problem is we can't live together on this planet. So, you know, there's getting to be more of us. So we need to find ways that we help each other, and that this is, it's kind of that whole sense of community. You know, and there's a lot of talk of world community, but we're not quite there yet.
What role specifically do the arts play in creating community?
I think, you know, for me, the arts right now are like a platform that Native artists have, that a lot of other people in the community do not have. We can be more vocal. We're more visual within the community, within the larger community, and we're able to discuss issues that need to be brought forward, and do it in a kind of a humane way. And it's not complaining, but it's in a real way. And art is like illusion. Sometimes you can trick people into looking and understanding. Or, you know, same way with music, they're all becoming multi-disciplinary. So there's musicians and poets, and, you know, the students coming out of IA now are proficient in poetry, writing, music, painting.
Are any of them doing poetry in their native language?
I think so. You know, I couldn't point one directly, but, you know, everybody is trying to learn their native language. Or it's because when you sing and pray in your own language, it's different. And even for me.
Where are you from?
Well, I grew up with the Apaches, so I'm not Apache, but that's home to me, the White Mountain Apache Reservation.
And so you grew up with both languages?
I grew up with both languages, but in the 60s, you know, you were beaten for speaking any language except English. So when
were
I
you at
school,
a boarding school?
No, this is public school.
Really?
So it's really surprising to me that it hasn't been that long that this kind of initiative to learn other languages was completely barred during my, early high school, late elementary school. There was no speaking of any other language.
And yet you were able to retain some Apache language.
Well, I never learned it, but, you know, say like 3 years later, my younger brothers were able to have it in class. 1 hour a day was taught in Apache. So a lot of my younger brothers all speak Apache.
Isn't that amazing? But just in a few years, things changed.
Yes. So my father was a principal of the school. He did help institute that program. I don't know if it still exists or not.
We're talking to Joseph Sanchez, co-curator of War Paint, the exhibition at the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum on Cathedral Place in downtown Santa Fe. The exhibition War Paint is adjacent to the Antonio Frasconi exhibit that's part of Los Desaparecidos, the Disappeared. Was there a concept of making a connection between those two themes?
Well, I think the strength of Antonio Frasconi's work, the stark detail of these beautiful woodcuts discussing like such a harsh things as torture cells, and then the monotypes of people that are actually gone. There's no trace of them. Truly, the Disappeared certainly had an influence in us placing this war paint side by side to it, because we're worried about that same sort of thing happening here to us. Is it happening in Iraq? You know, it probably is. There are actual people being disappeared, and we're part of that. That's not a very humane way to be. There's no humanity at all in that kind of war. So, you know, I think it was important that we kind of speak to that a little bit and speak to how, you know, our young men are coming back in serious trouble. You know, they're not, there's no way to deprogram them from killing women and children. You know, they never recover from that. So, you know, it's, or just seeing the carnage, and it's a different kind of war than Vietnam, which was very bloody and up close in a lot of ways compared to this war, which is more gory, more arms and legs missing from this war. And they haven't even discussed the nuclear radiation from all the depleted uranium shells they use over there, which is, you know, affecting a lot of young men coming back. They have radiation poisoning from sitting in the tanks with these. So that, you know, it's okay to be patriotic, and I think it's important that we are. You know, I'm very patriotic. I enlisted. But at the same time, we need to really look at what we're patriotic about and stand strong as human beings. You know, we need to have a little bit more humanity toward other people.
Is there a significant anti-war movement within the Native communities?
That I don't know. You know, I don't think so. You know,
because there was one of the artists, I can't remember which one, said in the exhibition there's a text about how much they disliked war protesters. And
oh,
I was wondering if that had changed.
The guy who had two terms in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, it's if you served, it's really hard to talk, you know, to let other people talk about the experience because they haven't had it. And truly, I didn't get to go to Vietnam. as well, but I witnessed it from a different point of view. And certainly all the death and the fact that people didn't come back. So, you know, it's... I can understand that. I can relate to the fact that, you know, he doesn't really want to discuss the war with somebody who's protested, who's never had the experience. So, because it is a life-changing experience. You know, it's and one that's so deeply personal that it etches your soul, so to speak. You know, I know I'm changed for it. It changed the way I think about life in general. Because it was, the training itself was dehumanizing. They have to. You know, they make you say things you never would think of saying. And that you're looking at people that look like you and you're shooting them. It's, you have to be prepared for that. I don't think anybody ever is.
How did you get your own humanity back, which you seem to have done in the years since the end of your career as a Marine?
I think a lot of it was the help of a lot of elders who talked to me over the years, and I do a sweat lodge as well, so there was a lot of prayer and support from my own family, you know, and my own peers who were all military guys who went to Vietnam, and you know that we would get together, and I think that's happening within, I understand it happens up at Jimenez, the Pueblo, the veterans get together. You have to let a lot of that go. You have to openly be able to discuss it and let it go, because if you carry it, then it you know, it affects your whole life. You know, how you raise your children, you know, how you react to your own family.
Well, Joseph Sanchez, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Look for, I believe we're going to have a Conversations to Remember on the War Paint show, so look for that. I'm not sure exactly which date it is, but come and join us and talk about the situation.
And the Museum of American Indian Arts is at the is on Cathedral Place, right across from the Cathedral of Santa Fe in downtown Santa Fe, and the exhibition War Paint runs through the 13th of January, 2008. Joseph Sanchez is co-curator along with Mateo Romero.
All right, thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with author Fernando Garavito. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Fernando Garavito. He is the author of Praxis and Ambiguity of the Enemy, Práctica y Ambigüedad del Enemigo, published by Gaon Books of Santa Fe, in association with the Institute for Tolerance Studies. Ron Duncan Hart of Gaon Books and the Institute of Tolerance Studies also joins us, as does Diane Karp from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The book is one of the three finalists for the Best Book Award on a Political Theme for the New Mexico Book Awards of 2007, and Fernando Garavito will be presenting the new book tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe in conjunction with the Santa Fe Art Institute. So we're going to conduct this interview in English and Spanish, and I guess I'll ask the question in both languages, and you, Ron, will translate Fernando's answers.
Perfecto.
Okay. So you grew up in Colombia, and we'd love to know about your childhood and your family. Usted creció en Colombia. Por favor, díganos sobre su juventud y su familia.
Bueno, mi juventud fue la de un niño y un muchacho desplazado por la violencia tradicional en Colombia, que ya se prolonga a más de 50 años.
I was born in Colombia, and my youth was growing up in the violence, the long history of political violence in Colombia, that's been going on for more than 50 years.
Luego de hacer toda una vida alrededor del el trabajo literario y periodístico, me vi obligado a salir del país como consecuencia de esa misma violencia que no termina.
I lived an entire life in literature and in writing, and ultimately had to leave the country in exile because of the same violence.
Mi familia estaba conformada por mi esposa Priscilla Welton, quien murió recientemente, y por mis dos hijos, Fernando y Manuela. También tengo una hija mayor, Melibea, quien vive en Colombia. Pero mi esposa, mis dos hijos y yo vinimos a los Estados Unidos en busca de asilo político.
My family is been composed of Priscilla, the wife, the two children, Manuela and Fernando Jr., and an older daughter, Maribella, who continues to live in Colombia. The rest of the family has been living here in Santa Fe.
Was there a specific incident that caused you to make the decision to leave Colombia?
Sí. Yo tuve que salir de Colombia a raíz de las publicaciones que hice en El Espectador, uno de los principales periódicos del país, sobre la vinculación de la política con el narcotráfico y de la corrupción tremenda que vive el gobierno de Colombia, el actual gobierno de Colombia. A través de los grupos paramilitares me amenazaron de muerte, me iban a asesinar en mi salón de clases y tuve que salir en 24 horas del país, dejando todo lo mío.
After writing a series of articles for the El Espectador newspaper that was denouncing the connection of the government with the narcotráfico, the drug trafficking, some of the corruption that was going along with it, the paramilitary groups, I was threatened with being assassinated, literally in my own classroom, and in a period of 24 hours, I had to get everything, leave the country, literally.
And how did you get out?
¿Cómo has
salido del país?
Pues salimos en dos grupos. Salimos mi hija Manuela y yo. Tomamos un avión directamente a los Estados Unidos en una circunstancia muy difícil. Mi mujer, que hacía milagros, logró conseguirnos dos plazas en un avión que estaba completamente lleno. Y luego, un mes y medio más tarde, salieron mi hijo y mi esposa, también rumbo a los Estados Unidos, donde pensamos que podíamos hacer una vida de trabajo y una vida intelectual. Mi opinión sobre los Estados Unidos es que es un todo con el resto de Latinoamérica. Nosotros no podemos tener las fracturas que estamos teniendo en la vida política y en la vida habitual de los países. Necesitamos conformar un gran todo para que podamos avanzar hacia la democracia y la libertad.
My wife Priscilla was able to work miracles. In fact, she was able to get two seats on a plane that was totally filled. So we had to leave in two groups. Fernando leaving first, then the rest of the family coming later. And came to the United States in exile with the idea of being able to build a new life. And the important thing is that the countries like Colombia, it is important to be able to construct a new kind of life there, a new kind of political life, in which there can be democracy, there can be union, there can be a coming together of people.
What was the first state that you went to before you came to New Mexico? ¿Qué fue el primer estado?
Nosotros llegamos a Maine, un estado donde mi esposa tenía una familia que nos acogió y nos protegió mientras nos concedieron el asilo, porque una norma un poco extraña del país es que quienes buscan asilo, quienes buscamos asilo, no pueden trabajar en nada mientras se les concede el asilo. Entonces, personas de pocos recursos como nosotros, pues nos veíamos en una situación realmente difícil.
We arrived to Maine, where there were family members who gave us shelter during that time period. And one of the unusual laws in the United States is that people who are seeking asylum cannot work in the meantime. So fortunately, there was this albergue, this this protection by the family that gave us a place and support in the meantime.
And how did you end up in Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Bueno, estando en una situación muy complicada en, desde el punto de vista económico y personal también y, familiar, recibimos el apoyo de Cities of Asylum, que nos que me concedió a mí como escritor una beca de las que da la organización para escritores que están en situaciones difíciles. Esa beca tenía los fondos otorgados por Lanham Foundation y una de sus condiciones era que la familia, el escritor con su familia viviera en la ciudad asignada por la organización. Esa ciudad fue Santa Fe y nosotros vinimos acá en diciembre, el 23 de diciembre del año 2003.
We came to Santa Fe with the City of Asylum program. And the through that, I was the family was able to come here. I was given a fellowship as a writer. And one of the rules of that is that a person is going to live in the city where the support is given. And in Santa Fe, the Lanham Foundation was the one who was gave the support for this program and made it possible for us to come here.
You started then writing a column for La Voz del Norte in the Santa Fe New Mexican. Did you have, and the book is by and large a collection of those columns, did you have a vision when you started what kind of themes you wanted to write about? ¿Sabía al principio qué temas querían escribir cuando comenzó con esta columna del periódico?
Sí, comencé muy rápidamente en julio del 2004 a escribir la columna en La Voz de Nuevo México por invitación muy especial de Flor de María Oliva, la directora, y con ella conversamos sobre la necesidad de plantear las dificultades que viven los inmigrantes y los problemas que se tejen alrededor de la inmigración que es tan marcada y que tiene tantas especificidades en el sur de los Estados Unidos, concretamente en Nuevo México. Esos fueron los primeros temas que yo traté y poco a poco fui encontrando un espacio para hablar sobre la situación de los inmigrantes y más ampliamente las relaciones entre Estados Unidos y Latinoamérica.
As I began writing this series of columns in the La Voz, invited by Flor María de
Oliva. Flor de María Oliva.
And the original intention was to write about the issues of the immigrants coming into the United States and some of the difficulties that people were facing. Working on that theme and writing that issue, it gradually evolved and it got into more depth on that issue and then eventually into some other issues.
I noticed that you write relatively little about Colombia. Usted escribe relativamente poco sobre su país.
Pues relativamente poco, porque el país, cualquier país latinoamericano es simplemente el crisol donde se desarrollan problemas más generales. Encuentro que los problemas que enfrenta Colombia son los mismos problemas que enfrentan cualquiera otro de los países de Latinoamérica. Y ahora, curiosamente, son muy parecidos a los problemas que enfrentan los Estados Unidos. Por consiguiente, hablo poco de Colombia, teniendo siempre en cuenta que Colombia es el país más crítico, que tiene mayores dificultades en Latinoamérica por la tremenda presencia del narcotráfico. Una de las de los propósitos que debemos tener quienes más o menos participamos en la vida pública de los distintos países es evitar facilitar el proceso de colombianización que puede llevarnos a una tragedia como la que vive Colombia en este momento.
I do write little about Colombia, but one of the important things is that each country is a crucible of factors and events that are going on and sets of problems that come together. And like other countries in Latin America, Colombia has a particular set of problems. One of the things that has concerned me is that we be aware in the United States also of the potential of Colombianization of issues here, problems of drug trafficking, some of the other political issues that Colombia has gone through. And so even though I write about it a little bit, that is one of the things that concerns me.
What do you mean by Colombianization?
Sí, pero no.
¿Qué quiere decir con colombianización?
Con colombianización quiero decir que el país ha seguido un proceso gradual de deterioro. Comenzó siendo en los años 40 del siglo pasado una nación democrática, respetuosa de los derechos individuales y de los derechos humanos, y poco a poco, por la presencia de factores de corrupción primero y luego de un proceso de fascistización, de fascismo presente en la política colombiana, luego por la corrupción y finalmente por la gran tragedia del narcotráfico, vino a deteriorarse la situación de tal manera que en este momento es inmanejable. El enfrentamiento entre los grupos militares, todos manejados por el narcotráfico, se ha convertido en algo que no tiene solución. Y estamos enfrentados, yo pienso, a una fractura del país, a convertir el país en dos países o tres países, porque es perfectamente imposible manejarlo de otra manera. Pienso con tristeza en lo que es Vietnam del Norte, Vietnam del Sur, Corea del Norte, Corea del Sur, y no se me haría raro que algún día tuviéramos que hablar de la Colombia del Norte y de la Colombia del Sur.
The Colombia in the years, the 1940s, for example, was a functioning democracy and was functioning well, in a sense. But since that time, there has been the continuing deterioration within the country caused by a series of problems. Part of it's been corruption, part of it's been some fascist tendencies, part of it has been the drug trafficking. And these destructive factors have literally been tearing the country apart. And there, the fear is that Colombia might be torn apart, literally, into different pieces, as happened with North Vietnam, South Vietnam, with North Korea and South Korea. And one of the fears is this, that a country might not be able to hold again. We might eventually hear at some point about a North Colombia and a South Colombia.
Let's talk about United States intervention in your country. You wrote about, in 1948, the assassination of Jorge Eliezer Gaitan at the hands of the CIA. How did that event change the course of Colombia's history?
Sí. El gran punto de partida de la tragedia de Colombia es el asesinato de Gaitán en el año de 1948. Ahí comenzó la gran violencia, en lo que se llamó la gran violencia, y el proceso de la presencia del fascismo en el gobierno del país, que luego provocó grandes fracturas y una guerra civil no declarada, pero muy cruel, como que produjo la muerte de 300,000 personas en el curso de 5 años.
The assassination of Gaitán in 1948 really led to a breaking apart of the political process in the country. And it was really starting from that point that fascism began to develop. There was, including the political assassination of large numbers of people, and over a five-year period, during that time, there were 300,000 people who were killed.
El asesinato de Gaitán es una muestra clara de los fantasmas que se crea Estados Unidos frente a Latinoamérica.
The assassination of Gaitán is an example of the phantoms, the ghosts that are created sometimes within U.S. policy of fear toward things in Latin America.
Pocos años después, en 1962, los presidentes latinoamericanos se reúnen con el presidente Eisenhower, debe ser 1961, con el presidente Eisenhower de los Estados Unidos y declaran que es necesario proteger a Latinoamérica de algo que se llamaba el comunismo.
So it was only a few years after that, in 1952, that the presidents of Latin America got together with President Eisenhower.
62.
And then Fernando's revising it to...
After the Cuban Revolution.
Ah.
Okay. En 1961, 61. Posiblemente. Sí.
But the getting together was with the idea of trying to create a union to protect Latin American countries against communism.
Se creó un enorme problema que no tenía raíces. Y entonces, con la creación de esa lucha contra el comunismo, se crearon distintos focos de violencia que se generalizaron en todo el continente.
So, given this this concern at that point, and there began to be an increasing issue of violence, and points of violence began to occur in different parts of Latin America as a result of this fear of communism.
Latinoamérica no es lo que cree el gobierno de los Estados Unidos. Latinoamérica es algo muy distinto. Es un continente de raíces culturales profundas muy distintas de las que podría generar o las que podría consolidar un proceso tan extraño a nuestras costumbres como es el proceso comunista.
Latin America is a very different cultural setting from what is imagined many times in the United States and perhaps in the government. And the cultural bases of the way things work in Latin America would actually make it very different to function within a communist structure, within that kind of thing. And yet the fear is there that is a possibility.
Yo pienso que con la torpeza de los gobiernos, tanto de Estados Unidos como de los gobiernos latinoamericanos, nosotros creamos realmente el problema de una insurgencia comunista que no existía antes.
With the torpeza, with the kind of very slow, not very agile movement of the U.S. government in dealing with these issues, actually we began to create a situation that did not exist in and of itself.
Se crean los problemas, se agrandan los problemas, y se vuelven insolubles los problemas.
The problems get bigger and grow, and they actually become unsolvable in this situation of conflict that is produced out of this.
En este momento nosotros tenemos países como Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, que están expresándose políticamente dentro del proceso democrático, pero les estamos creando un condicionamiento que los está convirtiendo en enemigos, sin ninguna necesidad de que sean enemigos.
And at this present time, this continues to occur, for example, with Venezuela and some of the other countries, where we are creating a situation around those countries with situations of conflict that don't need to be there. They could be solved in other ways.
Y bueno, yo pienso que todavía podemos reconstruir un universo en torno a la libertad y a la democracia. Muchos latinoamericanos, y yo soy apenas un ejemplo de esos latinoamericanos, creemos que los Estados Unidos pueden reconstruir su posición frente a la democracia, que la ha perdido, realmente la ha perdido, pero esperamos. Y esperamos con fe, con confianza, en que alrededor de lo que fueron los grandes ideales políticos de este país, nosotros podamos construir un nuevo continente.
We have a situation in Latin America today where it is possible to create liberty and democracy. And the grand ideals that people in Latin America, not only myself, but many other people, see as possible and want. And that is the ideal actually that we're working for, and it would be important the United States be able to be a part of this.
To what extent do you see Latin American countries unifying politically and culturally toward these ends?
Hasta qué punto los países latinoamericanos pueden reunirse, unirse.
Se están unificando.
Nosotros tenemos en los Andes, por ejemplo, en toda la región andina de Latinoamérica, Ron Duncan, antropólogo, lo sabrá mucho mejor que yo, unas raíces culturales profundas que tocan con las culturas indígenas que fueron muy marcadas en esa zona y que nunca jamás fueron extinguidas y están vivas hoy, más vivas hoy que nunca. Son culturas que se prolongan desde México hasta Chile, siguiendo toda la línea de los Andes. Tenemos formas culturales precisas, sistemas de cultivo de la tierra, de organización social y política, de expresiones culturales y artísticas, de manejos artesanales, de creación manual, muy diferentes y muy específicos, muy propios nuestros. Las fronteras que nos crearon los españoles al romper arbitrariamente los países por las líneas, con líneas ficticias. Yo creo que poco a poco, no lo veremos nosotros, porque serán unos procesos centenarios los que faltan, pero poco a poco esas fronteras van a ir desapareciendo. Las culturas son realmente profundas, marcadas, difíciles de romper, como sucede en la frontera entre Colombia y Ecuador, que está rompiendo a los pueblos indígenas originarios, o entre Ecuador y Perú, que rompe también a los pueblos indígenas originarios, o en tantos otros sitios. Nosotros vamos nosotros tenemos esa raíz común que sobre la cual podremos construir una nación, sino una nación política, sí una expresión cultural que nos identifique frente al mundo. Todavía estamos en el proceso de la identificación que no hemos logrado, pero vamos abriendo caminos lentamente para llegar a afirmarnos como un todo.
There's a cultural base that comes from the indigenous roots of all of the countries, starting in the Andes, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, all through that region. But the actual fact is you can start in Mexico and go all the way down the western coast of South America to Chile, and you find very important indigenous roots to all of these cultures. And these roots come from different sources. There are cultural things. There are part of the visual expression, the way to manage the earth itself, are commonalities that people understand across these national barriers, national frontiers that were created by the Spanish. For example, between Colombia and Ecuador, there's a national barrier, but there's a very clear cultural union.
And tristemente no tenemos más tiempo, ya llegó el momento. We're so much sorry we don't have any more time for this conversation. I hope we can continue it in the future. Fernando Garavito, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ron Duncan Hart of Guyon Books and the unusually quiet Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And Fernando Garavito is the author of Praxis and Ambiguity of the Enemy, Práctica y Ambigüedad del Enemigo, published by Guyon Books of Santa Fe in conjunction with the Institute for Tolerance Studies. And the book is one of three finalists for the best book award on a political theme of the New Mexico Book New Mexico Book Awards 2007. And once again tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, Fernando Garavito will be speaking and presenting his new book in conjunction with the Santa Fe Art Institute, and he'll be signing books as well. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Adios.